go on to case 071403, Darrell Allen versus Nedra Chandler.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Dean Gramlich, and I'm appointed counsel for the petitioner appellate in this case, Darrell Allen. This is a appeal from an opinion by Judge Aspin below denying a writ of a habeas corpus. The underlying case dates back to 2002. My client, Mr. Allen, was convicted of armed robbery. In that case, there were actually two trials. He had the first trial, which involved the same witness list and the same evidence as the second trial, except for one major exception. The end result was a mistrial, the jury unable to reach a verdict. Judge Roedner, did you have a question?
Sorry. Did either the prosecutor or the defense attorney reference the post-arrest silence in closing arguments?
The post-arrest silence came up in the second trial, Judge Roedner, and there was no reference to the post-arrest silence in either summation. It came up right before the summations in connection with defendant's counsel's cross-examination of Officer Farmer. In the first case, there was also a cross-examination of, or the first trial, there was also a cross-examination of Officer Farmer, but this particular line of questioning didn't come up. But in answer to your question, no.
Other than the reference to post-arrest silence, what other difference were there in the testimony presented at the second trial as opposed to the first trial?
There were no material differences. I have one advantage that Your Honors do not have. I've read the record in this case, and the record under 2254E was never placed into the district court record below. And I know the state's counsel believes that that's not necessary. But the evidence was essentially the same in both cases except for this particular item, and obviously the result in the first trial, the jury couldn't reach a verdict of guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. And there had to be a second trial, and my client was convicted of armed robbery and sentenced to 48 years in prison, which he's still serving. The trial court's decision was appealed, but not this particular issue. Appellate counsel didn't raise it, and the issue came up in connection with a post-conviction proceeding. That petition was dismissed, and then the matter was appealed to the Illinois Appellate Court in a case that we refer to as Allen 2. And I'll discuss that in the course of my argument. Three issues that we've raised, the first being, was the test used by the Illinois Appellate Court to determine prejudice under the Strickland standard in compliance with Strickland? And that test, as enunciated by the Illinois Appellate Court, was whether the scales of justice had been unfairly tipped in favor of the state as a result of what I'll refer to for shorthand purposes as the Doyle violation evidence. I have not located this particular formulation of the Strickland prejudice standard in any other case. I think it goes beyond the level of imprecision in language. I understand it. Judge Roedner, did you have a question?
No.
Oh, I'm sorry. I think it goes beyond the...
If she has a question, you'll hear it.
Okay. I think it goes beyond the imprecision noted by the United States Supreme Court in Wood versus Viciotti, and also by Judge Posner in his opinion, in the court's opinion in Stanley versus Bartley. I've never seen this formulation before. I think it bears close resemblance to the standard stated, or the wrong standard, is stated by Justice O'Connor in Strickland. When she said that a test that required the defendant to show by a preponderance of evidence that but for counsel's error, the outcome would have been different is simply too strict. It could also be argued that the tipping the scales standard as used by the Illinois Appellate Court resembles some overall fairness determination as enunciated by Justice Rehnquist in Lockhart versus Fretwell, which is only applicable in very limited situations, as explained by Justice O'Connor in that case. Frankly, Your Honor, I'm not sure that this test is at all a formulation which is any way consistent with the Strickland standard. The state cites various instances in which Illinois Supreme Court decisions were cited, but those standards themselves are not consistent with one another. Those cases are People versus Flores and People versus Albanese.
Tell us, counsel, what's your best argument as to why this decision should be reversed?
My best argument as to why this decision should be reversed is because the Illinois Appellate Court didn't apply the right prejudice standard. I think it relates to my second argument.
Isn't there overwhelming evidence of his guilt?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, and I believe that can be demonstrated by looking at one significant issue.
Well, he was in the store twice that same night. Is that right?
He was in the store, according to the witness's testimony, Ms. Smithson, on two occasions.
Wasn't he? He was a customer of the store before that night.
He was well known, wasn't he?
I believe she testified that he was in the store one time prior or earlier in the evening, not long before the offense in question.
He came in, entered the store, and he left without making a purchase.
Yes.
That the only time she ever
came in?
I believe she testified that she had seen him on other occasions.
Other occasions. He had been there before.
How many times? I do not know, Judge Bauer.
He had no mask on.
He had no mask on.
All right. He was a regular customer, wasn't he?
I think she testified that he frequented the store, as did his mother and other members of his family. With respect to the ID testimony,
they had a surveillance camera on, didn't they?
Yes, but it didn't work very well. I think that's shown in both the Illinois Appellate Court majority and the dissenting opinion authored by Justice Slater.
Some would say, I suppose you'd agree, that the state's case was actually undercut by the surveillance video.
Absolutely. Judge Rogner, because she could not, upon reviewing the surveillance video, identify his first entrance into the store on the evening in question. Indeed, the record reflects the fact
is
that...
Is the surveillance camera better than her own eyesight? Is that what you're arguing?
Surveillance camera better than her own
Own eyesight and her own observation.
It's certainly more definite evidence, Judge Coffey, than... her own eyesight. Given the circumstances, I would say that she was probably apprehensive during the course of the robbery, and during the actual course of the robbery, the
that's
defendant's
what you
entry
suspect,
into the store.
That's what you want to argue.
That's not what I suspect or what I want to argue. It's what the record shows in the case, I believe. And again, I would urge the court to consider having the district court look at the entire record in the case. As far as the surveillance camera, I would note not only was she unable to identify my client on his first entry in the store, but apparently the tape did not contain
his... On the surveillance camera.
On the surveillance camera.
Right.
But the tape apparently didn't contain anything on with respect to the first entry. So there was something wrong with the tape. Again, the hung jury is highly relevant, and if you're going to look at a determination of the outcome in this particular case... I think it would be important to focus on that. There was overwhelming evidence of guilt at the first trial. There would have been a conviction. There was no conviction.
Well, that's kind of wild guess and speculation. I mean, you and I know the juries do all sorts of funny things, bring in guilties when there's evidence of lack of that. And you know, we can even name a famous trial where the guilt seemed to me to be obvious that the O.J. Simpson walked away. So, pick a number. You can't say that. They even bring in guilties or not guilty. I don't know what jurors do, and neither do you.
I know that the jury in this case did not hear this evidence the first time and heard the evidence the second time.
That much I agree, but you
and
don't
the outcome
know
is completely different as you look at the facts. That much I can tell you, and therefore it's easy to argue that it was outcome determinative because no such evidence was offered the first time. The second time we get a completely different result with the same evidence.
Different jurors too, so that's another fact of the.
You're way into.
Yes, I'm into my rebuttal, and I'll reserve the additional time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Tormenting you with questions. Okay. Mr. Levin? Levin or Levin?
Levin.
Levin. Mr. Levin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. I'm Assistant Attorney General Eric Levin on behalf of the respondent appellee, Nedra Chandler. I'll start with the evidence here. As Judge Coffey noted, the evidence here was at least very strong. I think we can at least say that. We had very strong eyewitness testimony here.
But didn't the store video contradict at least part of the eyewitness testimony? See, what I've been mulling over and trying to figure out is how a court can reasonably conclude that evidence is overwhelming where an entire case is based on one eyewitness's testimony and the store video indicates that her recollection is erroneous at least to one aspect.
Your Honor, I beg to differ with that characterization. The video didn't undercut the eyewitness testimony. At the most, it was just of too poor a quality to be able to confirm the testimony. She was able to pick out the defendant walking into the store the second time, the time that he actually committed the robbery. She was unable to point him out the first time he entered the store, but she was clear in her testimony that he'd entered the store twice.
She couldn't pick him out on the tape.
On the tape, she couldn't point to where he was entering, but I wouldn't say that that is the tape contradicting her testimony. It's just that the tape... The
tape was of such poor quality, she couldn't tell who was who.
Exactly, yeah. Okay. I mean, we've all seen surveillance cameras. A lot of times it's not a
No,
best
we all
quality.
Haven't, but some
well,
people have.
Some
you know,
people have. A lot of people
I
have.
I try to avoid them myself.
You should see him ducking under those cameras.
But
Jewel.
but the point remains that the thrust of the state's case was the eyewitness testimony. What, as Judge Coffey noted, what she saw with her own eyes. And this was particularly strong eyewitness testimony. It was she testified that she recognized him as a frequent customer, and that testimony was corroborated by the store's owner, who testified that he was a frequent customer. She testified that she had ample opportunity to observe him. She, at one point, he was in very close proximity to her.
Less than 1 foot away, is that right?
I believe that was the testimony, yes. He was right up, you know, right across the counter from her, I believe. She later then picked him out of a lineup unhesitatingly. There was no doubt in her mind about the identification of the defendant as the perpetrator. Now, when you're doing a Strickland prejudice analysis, as this court said in Epstein, it's essentially like a balancing scale. If you have strong or overwhelming evidence, as we do in this case, then I guess how I want to say it is the evidence in this case was strong, at least strong enough to offset under the Strickland prejudice prong any possible harm that would have come from this alleged error, assuming it was an error. And I think on this point it's important to note petitioner relies on Adams v. Bertrand, where the court said that it could not blind itself to the fact of the prior mistrial. I think there's 2 points to mention on that. First, in the later case of Tolliver...
You know, I don't recall... help me. I may have forgotten this. I don't recall a lineup. I recall a photographic array, but I do not recall reading about a lineup.
That's correct. I think it was a photographic lineup is, I think, the term that the state appellate court used.
Call it a photographic array. Not a line. A lineup is human beings standing in a line.
I think that's right.
Yeah. Well, the state appellate court referred to it as a photographic lineup, but I don't think that really makes a difference to the strength of her.
Maybe it's just one more error the state court made.
Well, on that point,
just
again,
the difference between the federal courts who are so fussy and the state courts who are less fussy.
On that point again, however, I should point out that the petitioner at no point, either in the district court or here, has ever challenged any of the state court's factual determinations, which, again, goes to our point about why the record in this case is not necessary. In the district court, the petitioner had counsel. He filed his petition pro se, but retained counsel to file a reply. And that retained counsel ended up filing, I believe, a 14-page reply addressing only these two issues. And that counsel never challenged any of the factual determinations of the state court and didn't find it necessary to submit the record or ask that the state submit the record. The district judge, too, did not find it necessary to submit the state court record. And again, at this stage, petitioner's counsel never moved to supplement the record on appeal with that trial court record, and has not argued either that the district court erred in deciding the case without the record or that the record is necessary because of an argument that some of the state court factual findings are not entitled to their normal presumption of correctness. So for this court's review, we have to presume that those state court factual determinations are correct. If I can just go back quickly to the hung jury issue, this court stated in Tolliver very bluntly that the fact of a prior hung jury is simply irrelevant to the issue. And Tolliver was doing a Brecht analysis, but that's, for all intents and purposes, similar to a Strickland prejudice analysis. And logically, that makes sense. We know for a fact there were different jurors on each jury. For all we know, the second jury, those jurors could have heard, if they had been sitting in the first trial, they could have convicted. We don't know. We don't know what the split was on that first jury. It could have been 11-1 in favor of guilty, and there could have been one holdout juror who, for whatever reason, couldn't vote guilty. We don't know why.
Would you agree that other than Smithson's testimony, that's the evidence. And having Farmer's testimony, the lawyer, that Allen, you know, was uncooperative when he was asked about the crime, that was horrendously damaging to Mr. Allen's case.
I disagree. And I think a good analogy here, if we compare this to Adams v. Bertrand, which petitioner relies on, in that case, we had a situation where this court stated that the evidence was very close, the case depended entirely on the victim's testimony and her credibility. And what's important then is, how did the alleged error by counsel affect that testimony? In Adams, it was a case where the error was counsel failed to present a witness who this court said would have completely contradicted the victim's testimony. So in that case, that was extremely damaging, and that supported the court's finding of prejudice. In this case, this isolated reference to the fact that petitioner didn't answer any questions and wasn't cooperating, which, as opposing counsel pointed out, was not argued by either side in closing argument. There's no indication really that it was anything the jury would have considered. And most importantly, it wasn't anything that related to the victim eyewitness testimony the way it did in Adams.
So you don't think that additional evidence of his uncooperative behavior, his involvement in other criminal investigations, his refusal to answer questions related to the case, you don't think all of that would communicate to a jury that he was a criminal with an awful lot to hide? You don't think any of that would do that?
I really don't think, not coming from the state and not being argued in closing argument, I don't think that's something the jury really would have drawn.
Well, I mean, isn't it even worse for it to come from your own lawyer?
Not necessarily. I mean,
it's one thing for it to come from the state, but
not necessarily.
From your own lawyer?
Well, Doyle is very clear that the problem here, and I think petitioner referred to a couple times, is this evidence being inadmissible. That's not the point. The fact Doyle held that the use by the state of this type of testimony is improper, and the use for certain purposes. either to impeach a later given alibi or to infer guilt from silence. And neither one of those things happened here. And it seems unlikely that the jury would have drawn those inferences on its own without argument.
Really?
I don't think so. But I think that the important point, one, is we're under 2254D. And so the question is, was the state court's application of Strickland objectively unreasonable? Was its result within the range of defensible positions? And I don't think the court can say that. And even de novo, I think we have a situation here where the eyewitness testimony was strong enough when compared with this error, if it was an error, and as much harm as it might have done, we have enough evidence of guilt here that we can't say that but for that there was a reasonable probability of a different result. I see my time is up.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Gramlich, you've used almost all of your time. I'm going to give you one extra minute because that's all I can do.
Thank you, Your Honor, and I'll get right to my points. The Illinois Appellate Court never described Farmer's testimony as being isolated or insignificant. That's something the state describes in its briefs. Having this come from your own counsel in connection with a case is even more, the effect is even more pernicious than had the prosecution elicited the testimony. The jury would expect the prosecution to elicit such testimony and make such arguments. It would not expect the defendant to do so. There was no cautionary instruction as there was in Greer versus Miller, which basically saved that conviction. That was a Seventh Circuit case that was appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court and reversed primarily because of that instruction. And of course, I will note U.S. versus Hale, we've cited in our briefs, the significant prejudice that arises where post-arrest silence is offered as testimony and the effect that it can have on a jury when it realizes that a defendant has not cooperated. It conflicts with the natural presumption of the jury when it goes in to deliberate that if somebody accuses you of a crime, that you will be forthright in coming forth with some kind of an explanation. Miranda changes all that. Finally, I'll just say a few words, if I may, about the issue of appellate counsel. The argument basically, if there's no Doyle or Strickland violation below, there can't be any appellate counsel violation as well. We think that it was clear error not to have raised this issue on direct appeal. The transcript was short. The issue could have been gotten to fairly quickly, but it was not raised, and I believe it would have resulted in a reversal. Most important, and I'll be very brief, Your Honor, that standard on direct appeal would have been a de novo with respect to a question of law. That's not what the standard is before this court, as Mr. Levin just pointed out. It's much less deferential to the court. Now, I expect that I'm out of my time at this point.
Thank you so very much for allowing me to present this case to your
honor. I'm sorry.
We want to thank you for taking on this case. You were court appointed. You have really served your client and the court in the highest possible tradition.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. And we thank you, too, Mr. Levin. And you